Hello, Toasters. Welcome back. Here we are then, episode 2 today of My Mate Bought a Toaster, series 5. Can't believe it, guys. How have we got here? How have we ended up in this mess? So last week, of course, the fabulous Tim Key. Thank you very much for all your messages. Thank you very much for all your tweets. Really, really nice of you. This week, I start the interview today with a real gush. See if you can detect the moment when I start gushing at my guest. Because, you know, I mean, it's not every week you get to talk to someone who you spent your childhood watching on TV. I mean, I loved Blackadder when I was a kid, sure. And eventually I started watching things like Alan Partridge and all that sort of stuff. But the thing that got me loving comedy, like obsessing over comedy, was The Young Ones. It's just the very best. And if you're some kind of fetus listening to this and you've never watched The Young Ones, go on YouTube. I think loads of it's on YouTube now. And it's anarchic and mad, but just fantastic, fantastic stuff. So this was a real privilege. Stand by for the gush. Here is your Nigel Planer episode.
There's quite a strange experience looking back through what you bought.
Yes.
Did I really do that? Did I buy that many toe separators?
Oh, when I need a laugh, there's a helping people. But Tom Bice talking to these funny people. He's asking what they're buying in the town stories. Can somebody yell out the name of the show, please? It's My Mate Bought a Toaster. Oh, it's My Mate Bought a Toaster. Yeah, yeah, it's My Mate Bought a Toaster. Toaster for my love, thank God, toaster.
Hello and welcome along. This is My Mate Bought a Toaster, Tom Price with you as ever. And this week's guest is, I mean, I hope this isn't going to be awkward, Nigel, but you are a comedy hero of mine. You really are. Like, I adored you in The Young Ones, and I'm obsessed with Nicholas Craig. I have bought, if you looked at my Amazon purchase history, you would see 8 copies of I, an Actor, because I bought it for all my actor friends.
Wow.
I think you're wonderful. So thank you for doing this show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And thanks for saying that. Which edition, may I ask, did you buy 8 copies
of?
There's been a lot of editions.
I think I got it because didn't Steve Coogan come along and write a foreword for it? And I wonder if I've got
the latest edition. Yeah, Steve wrote a very good foreword. That's it, with foreword by Steve, who kind of was... It's been through about 8 editions, different photos, and we've updated the text, but it had just for the first time ever, I think, fallen out of print. And Steve got in touch with my agent to say, where can I get hold of it? So I got back to him and said, well, write us an introduction and we'll get it back in print again. Which is exactly what happened.
We should explain for dear listeners. So Nicholas Craig is one of your many characters who is plucking a random actor and not at all who he's based on, but maybe a Simon Callow-esque, shall we say.
He's in fact based on myself.
Yes.
Rather strongly. It's about the traits of an actor. The way to say it maybe is to put a double R on the end, an actor. to explain, and he originally in the mid to late 80s we wrote his biography called I, an Actor, with the subtitle Another Great Actor Explores Himself. And We've done many rewrites since then. We did some telly series of short programs, you know, how to do a gardening program, how to act a gardening program, how to act to travel. These were his masterclasses, how to act a TV chef. And we did a radio series in the early days too. And then live, he's been out live. He used to do award ceremonies, giving away the award for the best comedy play. This was for real. But I kind of stopped doing those because it got a bit scary taking the piss out of, for example, Sir Trevor Nunn or somebody, you know, doing jokes at the expense of when he's sitting 2 rows in front of you in the audience, not laughing.
You don't have that Ricky Gervaisian desire to roast people in their faces, because I don't either. I find it excruciating.
No, to roast people at all, I find I'm the opposite end from from Ricky Gervais. In fact, I've had to, with Nicholas Craig, there's a couple of times I've had to apologize to people. I felt it beholden on me to apologize.
Really?
Yeah, because you get carried away with taking the piss, you know.
Yeah.
And things do need debunking. We all need it, but... Yeah. And with Nicholas Craig, I feel it's based on me a lot of, you know, it's written in conjunction with Christopher Douglas. He's the writer on it, who writes Ed Reardon and performs Ed Reardon. He comes from an acting background, both his parents and himself. So we were kind of pissing on our own doorstep. The satire is, you know, very much based in our own, it's an alter ego from ourselves. Nevertheless, we have insulted a few people quite badly. And I had to apologize to lovely Tim Piggott Smith once because we stole a photograph which was a bit out of order. We hung around with a photographer a few feet away where you wouldn't notice him.
Yeah.
The stage door of the National Theatre.
Yeah, the Nash.
And then as great actors came into the stage door, I snuck up behind them and pulled faces to make it look like I thought they were my great mate, unbeknownst to the actors. And the victim on that occasion happened to be Tim Piggott Smith. So I snuck up behind him. I didn't know him. And sort of did a kiss towards his ear kind of thing. And this photo got into the Evening Standard. And it sort of said, Tim Piggott Smith is, you know, great mates with this idiot. What does he think? I don't know. Anyway, I then met him later and was very aware that I owed him an apology.
Oh, but it's so ripe for the sending out the acting world. And we'll get onto that. We'll dig into that while we go through your purchase history, which is what we are here to do. This is My Mate Bought a Toaster, and we're going to go into your Amazon account. Now, you have sent me about a billion screenshots of your Amazon history. We're going to go back to 2011, and it seems that the first thing you bought, read and write Hindi script.
Yeah. Devanagari script, yeah.
Yes, okay. Sure. Why? So what's going on here?
I decided to learn Hindi, and I went to class.
Yeah.
I was at it, a few years, and I got not like a European language, which I'm not bad with. I'm currently learning Spanish online,
right.
and I can speak that. You could say, well, I can say that. I can even read it, and... You can make progress quite fast, but with Hindi, it's so complicated. That progress was slow, but I really enjoyed the challenge of keeping up with the class and learning, you know, the alphabet's different. It's not just the alphabet's different. It's the whole way of phrasing things is different. The verbs at the end.
Right.
I mean... If you did a literal translation, you would say something like, me, this shop in, new shoes, meet, can I?
Bloody hellfire.
That's how your brain has to work. So you'd have to then re-scramble that to say,
oh my God,
can I meet some new shoes in this shop? And what it means is, can I buy some... Do you sell new shoes in this shop? Because they use the word meat in many, many different ways, you know. So it's complicated.
I've only ever done French, bit of Spanish, bit of Italian, and had a disaster with Latin. But you forget how much those languages are, well, geographically very close to us, you know, not too far away. As soon as you venture out, like my friend was into German, and then you've got nominative, vocative, accusative.
Yeah, German, and German has a different word order as well, doesn't it?
Oh, because I think I'm very clever for being able to do a bit of holiday French, but the idea of leaping into this, was there a reason that you decided to go into Hindi? Is it just an intellectual kind of pursuit?
No, I've had a long fascination with association with Indian culture, history.
Right.
I first went there a bit disastrously in 1973 when I was just coming up to 20.
Why was it a disaster?
I got very sick. I went away. I didn't have any money. I went overland on my own through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Yeah.
And I was away for about 6 months. The disaster was I didn't tell my parents.
What do you mean? Where you were going?
Yeah.
That
was a bad thing to have done.
So what did you say to your parents? Did you just disappear? Did you run away?
Nothing. Yeah. I went.
Wow.
My girlfriend at the time, who came, it started in Italy, no, France. I was on a sort of holiday busking in France.
Yeah.
I was in contact. I can't remember because you can't say I was in contact on phone because to book an international call in those days, you had to go to the post office, book it, and then come back 4 days later when it was booked and stayed in the queue and then go in a booth and say, yes, you can speak to France now. I just got a duffel bag. And
that is extreme gap yearing.
A little bit of money, but not really enough. And ended up in India and I got sick. I got as far as Varanasi and I then came back overland as well. Very sick, lost much weight. I was under, I think it was about 7 stone, and I'm 6'3".
Bloody hell. That's my height. So, that's under half my weight now.
Yeah, wow. Well, it's under half my weight now, yeah, too. Yeah. And I got very sick. I went to Hospital of Tropical Diseases for a long time and gradually got better.
Oh, my God.
And that was a sort of formative experience.
Yes, it would be. Yes.
Which, but I had, when I got there, I had a, it's a very cliched thing, but a kind of pull. I didn't want to come back. I came back because I was sick and I knew I couldn't cope.
Yeah.
But I had, I felt the cliched pang, whatever it is, the draw to India and Indian people, which is a bit, you know, and since then I have studied and read and learned more because I felt compelled to do so, to sort my mind out and get a realistic view of it. And I got obsessed as well with Indian cinema, as we will no doubt see later on.
Yes, indeed.
There's a hell of a lot of Indian films.
Yes.
I started to go back there in it took me 10 years to sort of pluck up the courage to go back, or maybe more. And then for a few years, I was going back there with my wife all over. Stopped going back there 10 years ago, maybe.
Okay.
But we used to go back every year and I'd go to various areas and take interest and read Indian history, literature, politics, and got a bit obsessed with it and then thought, this is ridiculous, I must learn it. I must learn to speak this and read it because it would be a great challenge. It would feel good.
Yeah.
And I got a bit of satisfaction from that by one time we went back to a place in Rajasthan called Mount Abu, where I had been very sick when I was on the beginning of the journey, really, well, the middle of the journey, and a chap called Mr. Arine had kind of taken me under his wing, saw me every day, made sure I had some breakfast, walked me round the town, told me the legends of each of the gods that were all around, but also told me the history of the British, took me to the cantonment where the British graveyards are from 1857, explained to me a bit of the bitterness towards the British. You know, I got a more rounded picture from him. I revisited this town, well, it must be 10 years ago now, with a smattering of Hindi that had taken me years to learn. It's quite hard to, you can't get fluent in it. It's difficult.
Yes.
So I went to the bazaar where I remembered the shirt and searched around asking people in Hindi. Mm. I was able to say, you know, do you know Mr. Arine's shoe shop? Is he there? It turned out somebody said, well, he died.
Okay.
But his son is here, and I found the Bata shoe shop where he'd been, and his son was there. There were pictures of him on the wall and his wife, who did now deceased.
Right.
The son said, yes, I remember you. He would have been five.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he did remember me, but then the uncle came, load of people come to the shop, and I was able to just about say, you know, your father was very good to me. He was a good man, and I'm very grateful to him because he was, you know, if it hadn't been for him, I think I might have dissolved completely.
Do you think you were that ill when you were there then? It was almost near death. You were that poorly when you had the...
Not at that point, I wasn't. Right. But by the time I got home, I was, yes. I hit the jackpot in the Hospital of Tropical Diseases for malabsorption, where this was my initial comedy routine, actually, in the comedy store. The first time I went on my own, not in the double
act. All tragedy leads to comedy. There you go.
Yeah, which was about I used to just stand up and describe the villi in my gut, which are the little, they're the little sort of wavy bits of seaweed type of thing inside your gut that catch the food as it goes down and absorb the vitamins and the nutrients. And if you have enough bacteria build up and bad shit going on,
it's all blocked.
The villi get stuck together and eventually they flatten so that the food falls straight through you, as it were, anyway, that was my comedy routine. And to sort of cap it all, the illness I had was called tropical sprue.
Yeah.
Which people laughed at the time, and nobody believed that there would be an illness called sprue. And
that's so good. That was your bit. But this is, you know, it was that back then, as it is still today, any comedian I know, something goes wrong, we all say to each other, mate, it's a good Edinburgh show next year. It's the way it works.
Yeah, I suppose so. I never got to do a good Edinburgh show, but I suppose I, you know, Neil the Hippie, if you look in the opening titles of The Young Ones, there's a picture of him in the university library leaning on the palm of his hand asleep in the university library. And behind him on the wall, it says School of African and Asian Studies. Which is where I went to the School of African and Asian Studies. This is before I went to India. I was already interested in the Eastern cultures. And we made Neil a failed student at the School of African and Asian Studies, as I was, because I dropped out. I never completed that course.
Right. Well, of course, going around India in the 70s, you're going to see a fair few Neils, aren't you?
There was a lot of them, yes. And I was a bit of one myself. I mean, again, it's a making an alter ego. You base a fair bit of it on your own flaws. Rather like that Neil Innes line, you know, I've suffered making this music. Now it's your turn. It's like, you know, these are my terrible flaws. And now you can go through them.
Yeah.
You know, now you express them. But it is entertaining. People laugh.
Oh,
you've got to laugh at your own shortcomings.
You have to. And you have to monetize your own shortcomings as well. That's the important thing.
Yeah. Ooh, my big boy, a toaster. My big boy, a
toaster. Shoving on lines that have been so far, my big boy, a toaster. Moving on. Look, that's one item.
Yeah, sorry.
That's what you've got. You've sent me about 80,000. No, if you did that long after each item, we're going to be here till Christmas, which is fine by me, but I suspect you have things to do. 3rd of November, 2011. Hmm. Well, hello. Look at this. You've bought the Black Brain Saver, the Hollow AirTube hands-free headset reduces 98% of harmful radiation emissions generated by cell phones.
Oh, yeah, that thing. God, I didn't even notice that when I sent you that. Is that's that tube so that it when people were getting all worried about wires from the mobile phone.
Tinfoil hat.
That's right. Yeah. The tinfoil hat. And I saw the ad for this thing, which is a tube of air where the vibration happens at the mobile end. Then the sound goes up the tube and you put it in your ears. And It's half off your dick. What if I get it? And it really works. It really works really well. But you can't really... The only thing it doesn't do is transfer, you know, what people have seen.
I mean, it's great. You don't, you know, you don't get brain cancer from the waves, but you die of a heart attack from the stress of not being able to hear anyone.
Or you chuck it in the bin.
Well, you know, there we are. Those guys were, you know, they were the frontiers people of the 5G terror, weren't they? They were out there already in 2011 getting us all terrified about stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been a good idea if it had worked, I suppose. I was getting headaches and a sore ear and things, so I thought, oh, maybe that's it. But
well, I only ever speak on the phone on my left ear. And not that we speak on the phone for very long anymore, do we, really? It's more sort of voice notes and emails and maybe a video call and stuff like that. But sometimes if I had a good half-hour chat on the phone, I would have a burning ear.
Absolutely.
But I don't think that was from radio waves.
No, it's just heat. It's just heat, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. No. Yes. A piece of metal jammed to my ear. Okay, what else have we got in 2011 before we move on a year? We've got The Big Lebowski, brilliant stuff. The Life and Loves of a She-Devil by Faye Weldon and She-Devil the DVD. Any reason you've gone for both those in July 2011?
Yes, there is. I am the writer of a stage musical based on She-Devil.
Oh.
I'm a friend of Faye Weldon's, and we got talking one weekend, and I thought, I worked a lot in musical theatre at the time, and I thought, this would make a great musical. And
give us the nutshell of the, what's the She-Devil story?
The She-Devil story is a woman who has a husband who is unfaithful with Mary Fisher, who is, in the original version, is a sort of romantic fiction novelist, very, very successful, thin, beautiful. In our version, we've updated her. She's like an influencer. She's, she's everything. She's got more followers than anybody. She's perfect. And she's so gorgeous and everybody worships her. And Ruth, who is our protagonist, is not. She's kind of lumpen and self, you know, self-deprecating and miserable. And her husband is an accountant, a rather sort of he's a sort of boring man who thinks he's incredibly interesting. And he moves in with Mary Fisher. He has an affair with Mary Fisher. And says you're a, and you're a, at some point he comes up with the thing, you're so awful. He's horrible to his wife. He says you're just, you know, how can you expect me? I mean, what do you expect to stay with someone like you? He's really horrible, and says you're like a devil. You're like a she devil, and she says, well, if I'm a devil, right? I'm, and she summons the devil, and takes revenge on not just him and Mary Fisher, but basically the whole world, the church, politics, everything. She wreaks destruction on everything and embezzles all his money, gets him put in prison. And
this is the dream.
And then spends all the money on plastic surgery to make her look like Mary Fisher, and then becomes Mary, gets more followers than Mary Fisher. In the meantime, Mary Fisher, she dumps her children on Mary Fisher and her husband. So she says goodbye to the children. Why should I just love? Why should I be the woman who sits around being the receptacle and cleaning everyone's mess? I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm going to do what I want. She shags anything she wants. She is corrupt, takes on lots of different people's identities in order to undermine everybody.
Okay.
And then Mary Fisher has a terrible time because she's got the perfect home, and suddenly she's got these two resentful children.
Those will slow her down. They'll slow her right down.
And Ruth manages to undermine that affair by pushing further temptation in her employment. Further temptation on her husband. So her husband starts having an affair with his secretary who was placed there by Ruth.
Oh, Honey Trap. Lovely.
So Mary is now alone with these children, and she's running out of money because she has to pay her husband's lawyers for. And Mary is gradually being destroyed, but finds that she loves these children.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
She finds that actually she's gaining more satisfaction out of caring for these children. And then she dies of cancer.
Oh, fucking hell. What?
Sorry about that.
Fucking
that's the
hell.
Story.
What? I was really on board then. I was even writing down She-Devil, Faye, well done. Bloody hell. Then she dies.
Yeah, because the end is pretty dark. It's dark in the book and it's dark in our show.
I wonder how many of my listeners were just gravitating towards getting the book on Amazon and just went, yeah, you're all right. Yeah,
no, all right. But it's beautiful, especially in our musical.
Yeah.
The music has been written by Hannah Jane Fox and Andrew Holdsworth. And it's right. Absolutely, it's not like, you know, a musical. Hey, we're off to see a musical. There's jolly bits.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But it's more like, well, Hannah worked in We Will Rock You with me. She was the original Scaramouche. The music is big and inspiring and sort of, oof, it gets, yeah. There's one song at the end when they're both, one of them's having plastic surgery, one of them's in for cancer, and they're both in hospital beds. And they sing a song where they're put under with morphine, and they it's a duet, and they sing "I Am Five." They remember their childhood. I am five, and I am skipping. I am five, and it gradually they become more separated, and you realise they're both possible destinies of the same person, really.
Oh wow!
It doesn't matter.
Bloody hell!
And it absolutely pulls your insides out listening to some of this music. It's beautiful.
I tell you what's connecting with me thinking about that story. It's quite timely. Is, and maybe you have this as well. I do my job as an actor, as a comedian, podcaster. There's always people doing better, and you can get so tied up in knots looking at people's better Twitter numbers, better podcast numbers,
oh,
better this,
God,
that.
Yes, I know the
and
you,
yeah. Right, okay. And I've got these. I'm the luckiest man in the world. I've got these two beautiful boys, and often I will find myself staring at my fucking phone, which I want to smash to pieces. And I say it every week on the podcast, and I still haven't done it, guys. And I'm looking at all these things, and I'm peering into a world of resentment and jealousy. And yet in front of me is the best thing that anyone could ever ask for. So that story really kind of struck me halfway through.
Ah, that's great.
And how do you cope with the thing I've just alluded to, with the career stuff? Have you always been, because my acting friends especially are divided into people who genuinely don't mind, genuinely take pleasure in other people's success, and then the rest of us who get bitter and twisted. Do you have mechanisms for it? Do you swallow it? Do you sort of let it go? What's your way of dealing with it?
Oof. Yeah, both of those. Sometimes I'm surprised by how good I am at it. And then the rest of the time, I'm just so sort of snidey and bitter and twisted. I don't know. I met Richard E. Grant once, and we were talking because he'd just written a book. I'd just written a book. And somebody, for example, Adrian Edmondson or, you know, somebody who I might feel that I was in competition with. It might not have been Aid. It might have been somebody else. I'd also written a book. Mm-hmm. And this unknown Adrian example person's book was doing a lot better than Richard E's or mine.
Right. Oh, right. Okay. Well, at least he was beating Richard E as well.
And I was saying, yeah, well, he's done the book. And, you know, it's not that brilliant. But he's had a good attempt, and the plot line's actually quite good. You know, I said something generous, and Richard E. went, "My God, you're good. That's amazing. You know, you how do you manage that? I could do with some of that." And I surprised myself because I hadn't realized, I hadn't ever thought of myself as being in any way generous spirited. Maybe it's something
it's
you learn as you get older. I think I am more generous now. I mean, I'm quite old now.
Nonsense. I think I'm better than I was. But hilarious that you should say that to Withnail and expect him to be generous for goodness sake. Of course, Withnail would be furious.
Find us on Twitter and Instagram at
Oyster Pot is the main way trying to jam. It's simple like a sarnie filled with cheese and ham. At Toaster Pot, at Toaster Pot, at Toaster Pot, I swear it's not a scam, I think.
Listen, I moving on, final thing of 2011. I can't believe we're still only on 2011. We should mention it. We mentioned it briefly, but I want to allude to it because I've been lucky enough to act in this twice. Oh. And it is one of my favourite things, certainly in radio, that I've done. And that's Ed Reardon's Week. Worth saying, Chris Douglas is a genius. The whole thing is magnificent.
Yes. And as you can see from my Amazon list there, I bought something like 5 series at once.
You went for it.
I went for it.
Yeah.
And that's because Christopher and I worked for years together daily on Nicholas Craig. He ended up directing the TV, co-directing the TV, directing the one-man show. You know, he was the Nicholas Craig is a we, not an I. It just happens that I'm the performer. It's a jointly owned project.
Right. Yes.
And for years, since the late 80s, we've been working. But then when the second or third edition of it, there was a period when I think he'd had enough around, you know, and it's when he wanted to start doing his other character, Bod, and he wanted to start doing his own thing. I think he got a bit fed up with being the guy who isn't, you know, Nicholas Craig in terms of appearance. And there was a period of a few years when we weren't so in touch.
Mm.
And then we got back in touch for some reason. Some Nicholas Craig came back in. I hasten to add, we're great friends now all the time, whether there's work or not to be done. You know, we're good pals. But so we got back in touch and I said, oh, what have you been up to? And he said, oh, I've been doing this thing, Ed Reardon, because I hadn't heard it. And I thought, Jesus, I better catch up with this. So I bought as much of it as I could and listened to it all in one go.
Isn't it brilliant? That's right. The story of brilliant. Ed, I mean, in a way, it's the writer version of Nicholas Craig.
It is exactly that. Yes, yeah. It's exactly the writer version of Nicholas Craig. And he sums up exactly what you were just talking about. The bitterness, self-aggrandizement, envy, and just general sort of malfeasance of the writer, of almost every writer you've ever met.
All right, we're going to skip ahead. Let's now go, Nigel, to late 2012. This is probably a Christmas present. You've got Connect 4 Classic. I just wanted to take a moment to say how much I love Connect 4. I was playing with my kids the other day. Great game.
Isn't it the best? And that is not so much a Christmas present as a something you can play with Dad.
Yes.
It may have been wrapped up at one point, but basically it's, come on, let's get down to it and play this game. It's excellent. Yes. And it's something your kid can win against you.
And you play it genuinely. I don't really hold back.
It's kind of random, and so that they enjoy it, you know.
Yeah. What's your kid's situation? How many have you got?
I've got, it's complicated.
Oh, right, okay, fine.
I've got two sons.
Yes.
Two stepchildren. Uh-huh. 7 step-grandchildren.
Oh, wow.
And one on the way great-grandchild and one existing great-grandchild.
Many, 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 many birthdays.
Oh. Yeah, a lot.
Oh, my goodness.
It's lovely. I feel... nestled,
yes,
in people, you know, it's really a good feeling.
Yeah, I've never spotted the word nest in nestled before. I like that. I like the verbification of a nest. Works for me. Yeah. Nestled in it. It's good.
Nothing to do with Nestle's chocolate.
No, not so much with the powdered milk. 2012, just a couple more bits on that. You've got the marvellous Caitlin Moran, How to Be a Woman. I adore her so much. She's so brilliant. And then next to it, you've bought 2 copies of Southwark Past by Richard Thames. And there's another one as well earlier on. You've got old pictures by John Betjeman as well. It's Victorian and Edward London from Old Photographs. I could look at old pictures forever. I could just look at them. I could lose myself in old stuff like that.
Yeah, those again, most of my book purchases seem to be to do with work related. This is to do with a book I've written called Jeremiah Born in Time, So he travels in time in Southeast London, in Southwark, through inherited memory and morphic resonance. So he doesn't travel in place. So you have to be, you travel in this setup I've written by remembering the past, even past that you haven't had, like a collective memory, like birds fly south because they've inherited this memory. There's a philosophy that says this is possible. And right. so he doesn't know he has this skill. But his mother is, unbeknownst to him, a fugitive from the future.
When did you write this?
I've been working on it a while. It's currently pledging on unbound.com. I'm at about nearly 60% pledged. You go to unbound.com, please do pledge, because it's as soon as it's fully pledged, it'll be published.
Unbound.com is brilliant. Yeah. Yes.
It's a funny book. I mean, it's a comedy book inspired by, it's a sort of in the territory of Blackadder, because the history is pretty accurate.
Right.
It's actually quite well researched, as you see from those books. But it's also in the realm of Terry Pratchett without the fantasy magic, other than the fact that they can travel in time. It's kind of the sort of pedantic comedy of a Terry Pratchett book. It's got that kind of, even in the future, they're having residence association meetings and sort of saying, no, well, I think we should look at Article 14 because it says the steam doors won't be. And so it's kind of irritating comedy, takes place in the same place, obviously, in 1910, in 2019, and in 2121. And also, he goes back to an unspecified place, possibly pre- or post-Roman, in the same place.
I'm obsessed with time travel. Basically, time travel and ghosts. Oh, I love time travel. Have you read the Jack Finney novel, Time and Again?
Oh, no. Somebody recommended me that the other day.
Yes, you must. You must. It's quite old now, but it's about a guy who goes back to New York in the 1890s. And so who was it? David Quantick, to slightly name drop, recommended it on Twitter to me. And it is like, He said to me, it'll go through you like a knife through butter and stay. He said something like, it'll stay with you forever. And weirdly, because at the time you read it, you think that was excellent. And I think about it all the time.
What's he called? David Finney. I'm writing it down.
Jack Finney. F-I-N-N-E-Y.
Yeah.
Time and Again. It's just a simple time travel novel, and you should read it. Yeah. It's
and
really good.
Yeah. Quantick is usually worth listening to.
He knows what he's talking about. Indeed. He does. So, Nigel, the book is on Unbound. What's the book called? So we can look
Jeremiah
it up.
Jeremiah Born in Time.
Jeremiah Born in Time. Very nice. Good plug. Okay, fine. All right. Listen, let's move on. Racing through your Amazon purchase history. We have got a lot of, as you hinted earlier on, lots of Indian stuff, Bollywood things. We've got Putty Buddies, earplugs. We've got some earplugs. Are you a sound sensitive man?
I am a sound sensitive man, and I use them on airplanes. Mm. And instead of getting those very expensive sound reducing headphones, which cost a fortune and are very bulky, shove a couple of Putty Buddies in.
You're done.
Same effect.
Yeah.
Fine. You can still watch the videos on the plane. But what I got them for initially was before the lockdown, I'm a swimmer and I used to go swimming very often.
Ah.
And if you swim a lot, you can get glue ear quite easily. You get water in your ear and it's really a nuisance and stops you swimming.
Yes.
And so I used to put the Putty Buddies in for swimming. They're a swimming aid.
I see. Do you still go swimming now? Are you still a swimmer?
I haven't been since the lockdown. I used to go sort of two or three times a week, but I haven't been since the lockdown. Just haven't haven't had the kind of courage, confidence to do so. But as soon as I feel, you know, that we're beyond the virus enough, I really miss it. I would love to go back.
Were you like a wild swimming hamster teeth vibe or just a normal Lido pool sitch?
Definitely not a wild swimming. I tried it once in a river.
Yes.
Where one of the guests, it was at a house party, one of the guests swam along and gashed the whole of her thigh open and something underneath. And you always think, I'm swimming away. What if somebody's just dropped a Ford Anglia?
Yeah,
down here. I'm going to scrape my stomach over it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my days, this is so embarrassing. I don't remember buying all these silly little strange things. I swear on my life, I was forced by my wife with an ABBA penknife that I bought on ABBA. Wait a minute.
This is 2016 now, Nigel. Shooting the Actor, Simon Callow.
Oh, yes.
You've got two copies, one for Nigel Planer and one for a man called Adrian Edmondson.
Did I?
Yes, you did.
That wasn't that nice of
you. You, what a lovely man. Confirming what a lovely man you are. And his was more expensive.
That's weird. A lot more expensive.
Yours was £6.47. And on the same date, 7th of July, his was £6.77. So 30p.
That's weird, isn't it?
Weird.
Very weird. Yeah,
get him to pay you that back.
It's a magnificent book by Simon Callow.
Right.
It's very funny. Sometimes one thinks unintentionally, or maybe he's intentional. You're never quite sure with Simon.
Mm.
It's about his shooting of a film in Eastern Europe by some famous Milos Gostepinkachenka. I can't remember the name of the director. Very famous Eastern European director.
Right.
And Simon's kept a journal.
Oh, dream.
And he had a bad time on this film. It wasn't his favourite thing. That's why he's called it Shooting the Actor. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is how bad it can get for actors. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of Simon-type actor moaning. It's just beautiful.
It sounds like a green room moan.
But being Simon, he's cleverer than that. Mm. He's allowed the director to interject and respond.
Oh, that's clever.
And the director replies, and it's actually a brilliant book.
That's like on a TripAdvisor review when the owner of the cottage has a right of reply underneath you slagging it off.
In a way, it's very interesting what it throws up. But the director is very mysterious, cryptic, and occasionally he'll do something like Simon has a go about you know, shooting the horse that he had to get on from the wrong angle or something, you know, some actor thing, which may have been a valid complaint on the day, you don't know. And the director will give you an 18th century dictionary definition of the word hysteria. And that's his entire response. Or he'll give you a little incident, rather like a Julian Barnes novel. He'll give you a little incident that happened in 19th century Poland about some guns that were stolen.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're thinking, how does that respond to what Simon said? Where's the cryptic clue to this?
Yeah.
And it's like Simon takes you into this other world. It's an absolutely brilliant book.
That's fantastic.
And I think Adrian and I were writing, we wrote a play together, which was then called Vulcan 7, which we took on tour.
Ah.
It's now called, it's heading straight towards us. And it's about two actors stuck in a caravan on the side of a volcano in Iceland.
Oh, great.
With a runner. And they're stuck there. The bridge back to the main part of the set collapses. And they're stuck. There's an avalanche. It's a very funny play. We took it on tour and we've now rewritten it. We were hoping it was nearly in the West End with Samuel West and Tony Gardner playing
bloody
the two
hell,
actors,
that'll do.
Which would have been that we did a reading the day before the lockdowns. And they were just, two favourite actors being brilliant.
Yes.
But we'll see what happens to it. But it's a very funny play. And at the time, I must have bought Adrian a copy of this book to get us in the mood.
Yes, I see.
For the thing, because the two guys are making a film called Vulcan 7.
Right. Obviously, as a young one's obsessive, I'm just really happy that that Neil is still in touch with Vivian. That's the most important thing. Do you guys, when you work together, when you write together, is it a case of physically not being in the same rooms? Do you do it remotely and then you come together? Do you swap scenes? What's your approach? And are you planning more stuff with Adrian?
We got halfway through writing a second play, actually, and then the lockdown happened.
Okay.
And then he does go off filming. I mean, I still do a fair amount of acting, but he likes to really do every acting job that comes along. So he's less available than me. No, I used to go around to his place. And there's always a pacer and a typer, as it were. But Adrian likes total control. So he wanted, you know, it's on his Apple technology. It's on in his house.
Right.
So he's got the notes in different files and things. So it was quite a nice gig for me because I'm all in cardboard folders and scribbled notes and, you know, different files. And then it'll be, let's have a look at Simon Callow's book, or it'll be, hey, I found an interview with some actor. Let's have a look at that and see what they said. That's funny.
Yes.
You know, I'm more distributed in the world, and he's very focused.
Nice for you to be able to sit there and pace there. Be the Chapman and Cleese is the one I always think of, isn't it? Cleese hacking away at the typewriter and Chapman sort of behind him, head in the clouds. Nice to play that role, though. Nice to sort of it's playing, isn't it? Literally,
it was good for me, and I didn't do much pacing because he's got a very nice sofa there in his room, and I just sat there. And sometimes his dog would come and sit on me and look over my shoulder, not interested in me, just looking over the window, out of the window. Beyond.
Using you as a human stepladder. I like it when dogs.
That's right.
Yeah,
yeah.
Big fan.
It was a good experience though, because he's I'm pretty organized, but he's very organized.
Is he?
Yeah.
Ah, right.
He's a real. I mean, I'm so impressed. Wish I could get half of that amount of
interesting.
You know, discipline.
Driven.
Yeah, we're both driven,
mm.
but I tend to, Boris would say, spaff it up against the wall more.
You mean Boris Johnson, our former Prime Minister? Yes, I know the one you mean.
Yes. I mean, I tend to get led by the next thing, that idea that comes to me, and he is pretty, he was a director. He can direct as well.
Mm.
He directed their movie. He directed the videos of Bottom. He's, you know, and to be a director, you have to know your way around the spreadsheets.
Mm.
You have to, you know, all of that stuff.
And
it's not a joke.
No. Well, as Nicholas Craig says, in fact, comedy is a very serious business. When you were doing The Young Ones then, I can imagine there's a lot of people with opinions. Did you find yourself drifting back, or were you forthright and stepping up and saying, no, we need to do it this way? Or did you allow it to happen?
Oh, you mean this time working with Adrian?
No, I mean when you did The Young Ones. So when there's all of you, all those huge personalities.
Oh, God. Yeah. It was a nightmare.
It was all young as well. So everyone's so loud and bloody full of it.
Yeah. And the trouble is, it's like in a family. You get a reputation for a certain behaviour mode.
Mm.
You can't be the one who does X because you did Y once, and somebody else is better at X than you at shouting loud. So you're not the shouty one, but you might have a big shouty bit of you.
Yes,
but
yes.
That is suppressed because your brother or your coworker they've taken that role, and so you get stuck in a certain mode, and. What was quite refreshing working with Adrian this time is there were vestiges of those old roles that came up.
Mm.
But because we're grown-ups now, we managed to sort of dissipate a lot of that. And so I felt I had, for instance, working with him this time, I felt I had more of a voice. He listened to me this time.
Yeah.
Which I don't remember a lot of that going on.
No.
In The Young Ones days, because there was such a scrabble for having the you know, the voice. I think my role was to be pedantic, annoying, and finickety and just grind everything to a halt.
Yeah, okay, right.
Until I got my point. And I think they found that pretty annoying.
Patreon.com/toasterpod. All right, listen, let's move on. We're getting towards the end now. Where are we now? We're in 17. I'm going to quickly stop off on this one before we leap into more recent purchases. Nigel, 15th of December 2017, someone's been Christmas shopping. They have bought some gel toe spreaders. Well, that's going to look lovely under the tree, isn't it? What a lovely Christmas present.
Yeah. Yes. I think you'll find if you scroll through a load of the purchases that that's not the only toe spreader purchase. I think there's quite a few. Yes, I don't use them anymore. I've given them up, I promise. But, you know, for a while the idea is you stop the carbuncles happening and it gets you, they're meant to make you walk better. And for a few years, I used them, and they get used up quite quickly because they go a bit.
That's a tricky wash in the understairs sink. What are you doing?
They're not nice, really. So you chuck them away and get some more.
Right.
But in the end, I felt that I was better doing toe exercises.
Oh my God, I love it. There's so many. Look, yes,
do every day. I instead do these toe exercises, which feels a better way around it.
Hang on, why do you need to do toe exercises? Does it, because the toes affect everything, don't they? They're tiny. But if someone was to take one toe off me now, I'd never walk the same again.
Yeah, balance. It's to do with balance. I had a lot of back trouble, and then more recently I fell and. In an annoying way, when you're not wearing wide enough shoes and your toes are compromised in the toe of the shoe and you've maybe got a bit of pins and needles and you get out, you do a dangerous thing like getting out of an armchair. You know, something as risky as that.
a stunt. And
something like, standing up out of an armchair and the foot, because the toes are not spread and doing their work, the toes fold under, so the foot folds under, so the whole of you falls over and breaks your ankle.
Yeah, and all because of the toes.
Which is what happened to me. All because of those outer toes not being spread enough. So pointy shoes, you won't find me having bought any pointy shoes in there.
Yeah.
Wide-toed shoes.
You're not a winkle picker. Did you break your ankle?
I did, yeah. A couple of small fractures on the ankle. This is a bastard thing.
I'm sorry to. I'm not laughing at that, but the description of the toes. It was like I was back in the comedy store watching your character talk about the gut problem. I mean, it was, you know, there's comedy mileage in talking in detail at length about physical ailments,
about really boring things. Yes.
Welcome to the show. All right, listen. Here's what we're going to do, Nigel. We are going to leap into the present. Right. We're going to see what's going on at the moment. So we've got a lot of eyeglasses straps. Excellent. A lot of these.
Yes.
Blimey, now I can see you wearing some right now. Nothing worse than losing spectacles.
Yeah. You've got to have the thing, and I wear them out. And those ones I got are one of those purchases. If you'll see, there's one lot that look really cool and sort of multicolored, and they're great.
Tim Wannacott. They look bargain hunt type. Yeah.
They're all kind of multicolored. Yes. Patterns and things like that. Yeah. Very nice. But they don't bloody work.
Oh, fuck.
The glasses fall out of them. So you go back to the boring one with the thick, heavy grommet that you can shove the glasses so they don't fall out.
Yeah.
I know it looks like you're some old auntie, whatever, with a glasses over your neck. But it's better than losing them every time.
Well, the other option is to do what my in-laws have done, which is to buy 450, and I'm not exaggerating here, pairs of spectacles. So they're just everywhere. Literally, at any point, you can reach out. Much like a baby in a cot looking for dummies. There's dummies everywhere. There's just, you go in their house, there's just glasses everywhere. That's one option.
I bet you if I did that, like Biro's, they would accumulate in some place that I cannot find. I bet you I could make that not happen. And even though I bought them, I'd be sitting down and going, I'm sure there was a pair here, yes. But there isn't.
And many years in the future, you should put this in your time travel novel. Someone will look under the sofa and find evidence of glasses.
Find 450 pairs of glasses.
Who was this bifocal man? Look, and then we've got a lovely bit of domesticity here for Nigel Plain. The 13th of January, 2021, and the Ability Superstore long-handled sponge. A sponge with a handle. That's evolution right there, isn't it?
It's bloody good. Oh. If you need, you know, I think this was around the time. No, when was that? 21?
A year ago, pretty much to the day where we are now. This is January 21.
It's not when I broke my ankle.
Right.
It's having an itchy back.
And oh.
No, you can. There's all sorts of things you do with a long-handled sponge. You clean your back. Mm. You can scratch your back.
Oh, with a dry sponge. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very good thing to have.
Absolutely.
Anything, actually, with a long handle. My dustpan and brush is a stand-up long-handled dustpan and brush.
Mm-hmm.
I've got grabby sticks.
Yes.
So you can, a long-handled grabby stick where you can pick something up. I don't like, because of my back, I don't like things at ankle height.
No, I completely agree. I've got a bad back as well, and it's a pleat pain. It's always good to finish on a high energy, quite literally. The SIS Go Hydro Hydration Energy Drink Tablets. Which bloody
loads of them. I think
you spent £55 on energy drink tablets, two packs of 20 tablets. So they're not cheap.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
Good. Love to end on an embarrassing moment. What's going on here, please? This is April.
£55. I didn't think. Wow, God, that's a terrible thing. I'm certainly not getting those tablets because I do so much exercise.
Mm.
It's to rehydrate.
Mm.
Because I dehydrate quite quickly and get, I had some back operations.
Right.
Years ago. And I find I get cramp.
Yes.
Down the nerve damaged part of the leg. I get cramp. This has been like a medical hour, hasn't it?
Well.
This is what it reveals. It's all.
I love it.
It's all medical stuff. It's all symptoms. Everything.
Yeah, exactly. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Symptoms. The Symptoms.
Yeah.
You get dehydrated easily and those bad boys step in and fix that for you.
I must have bought that without even noticing that price because that's a ridiculous price.
£55. Tell you what, though, could have done with that in India in the 70s, couldn't you? Gone full circle.
Absolutely.
We've gone full circle. Absolutely. We've done it. It's the My Mate Bought a Toaster dream when the last item tenuously relates to the first item.
Yeah.
Structure. Listen, this has been a delight for me, at least, Nigel. I hope you've enjoyed it as well. It's been so much fun looking through all the stuff you've bought.
Thanks, Tom.
Especially £55 on tablets. Impressed with that. Before you go, we should say you've got a fantastic podcast. Nicholas Craik has got a podcast out now. Let's do an absolute massive plug for that, please.
It's a six-part sitcom, podcom, is what Nicholas Craik calls it. And he is sitting there not knowing really how to work the technology, and he's decided that, unlike anybody he can think of, he's going to write a memoir, which actors never do.
No, they don't. Yes.
And it's about 20 minutes long, and he gets into, he's trying to talk about how marvelous it is being an actor, but because he's sitting in the front room with a microphone and a laptop, there's quite a lot of distractions and annoyances and things that happen to him. And a story kind of develops, which involves, strangely enough, Anthony Head.
Oh, okay.
Who is his kind of nemesis.
Oh, great.
And there's, because we were talking about who's your bitterness, yes, and envy. Of course, Nicholas Craig would say Anthony's, you know, a great mate and a smashing actor. But he does manage to say some fairly damning things about Anthony Head. Anyway, Anthony has very graciously, is a guest appearance in the podcast.
Oh, excellent.
And there's a little bit of sort of animosity between them.
Oh, delightful. Is he in the first episode? Is he in from the beginning, or is he?
No, he's not in the first episode. It's a slow burn. Oh, it's a slow build to how Nicholas gets himself in quite a lot of shit.
Wonderful. Fantastic. What's it called, please?
It's called I, an Actor, a Podcast.
I, an Actor, a Podcast. By the time you're listening to this, if that starts at the end of this week, by the time this podcast that you're listening to comes out, there'll be plenty of episodes already available. So I, an Actor, a Podcast.
Oh, that's great.
It's out now.
I, an Actor, the Podcast.
Go and have a listen. Yeah. Nigel Plenner, thank you so much for joining me. That was wonderful. I loved that.
Marvellous.
Brilliant,
great.
Brilliant.
Good fun. Lovely to speak
you
to you.
Too. Thanks, Tom. Cheers.
Bye.
Nigel Plenner on My Mate Bought a Toaster, or this week, as I think we'll call it, My Mate Bought a Toast Spreader. So it's a better title, not going to lie. Listen, guys, thanks for listening. Thanks for all your lovely messages. Thanks for all your ratings and reviews and subscriptions. I know it's mad. I go on about it all the time, but apparently it helps with the algorithms. That's what the boffins tell me. So any likes and all that business, it does make a difference. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all your lovely tweets. Next week, well, I'm thinking about getting the author Beth Morrie on the show. Her second novel, M and Me, has just come out. It's very, very good. She is a very interesting person, very funny. And she's also my wife. So she might come on the show, but it could get tetchy. We'll see about that. More info soon. See you soon. Bye now.
It's my mate, oh, toaster. Oh, oh. It's my mate, oh.